This is an ABC podcast.
For copyright reasons, the music has been edited. To hear the full tracks, listen to The J-Files, Thursday nights on Double J, or head to doublej.net.au and click on the track list at the bottom of each episode.
Kaz Tran here. Welcome to The J-Files, the podcast for people who love music. Each episode is like a quick music history lesson. We pick a different artist or band, we look at some of the most important moments in their career, and we celebrate their impact on music, all in less than 30 minutes. On this episode, it's one of the greatest rappers of all time. Now, who's hot, who not? Big by name, big by nature. The notorious B.I.G.'s stature as one of hip-hop's greatest MCs is without question. What's remarkable is how he acquired that huge legacy over just a few short years, and with only two studio albums to his name before he tragically died in March 1997 at 24 years of age.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and heavy D up in the limousine.
Christopher Wallace, otherwise known as Biggie, aka Biggie Smalls, and the notorious B.I.G., rose out of New York's East Coast hip-hop scene in the early 90s. It was at a time when West Coast gangster rap had come to dominate hip-hop, but Biggie's debut album, Ready to Die, changed all of that. Now I'm in the limelight cause I rhyme tight. To help us dive into his remarkable career, we have music writer, hip-hop expert and Biggie superfan Sosefua Mole joining us on The J-Files. We started out with the story of when Sose first discovered the notorious B.I.G.
So I was 7 when he died, but I have early memories of being maybe 8 or 9 and seeing the film clip for Juicy. It may have been on Rage or it may have been somewhere in my house at the time. I remember I had cousins who were very invested in the East Coast, West Coast beef at the time. So I have early memories of Juicy, but also early memories of Changes by Tupac kind of in my head. And I remember knowing that that was significant, but obviously not knowing why it was significant until I was much older. That was the first exposure I can remember to the notorious B.I.G. But then I remember getting into my teen years and really falling in love with just the way he presented himself as a rapper and as an individual. You know, like I think we always forget how young these guys were when they were at the peak of their career and then when they died. So to hear such a natural confidence on a record, I remember as a fan, that's what I connected to the most, being younger myself.
A whole lot of niggas want Big to make a demo tape, especially that bum ass nigga R. This going out to you, nigga. Recognize your 50, what's this?
Tell us a bit more about his childhood days. Now we're getting there, Sus. You know, he was raised primarily by his mother, mm-hmm. you know, and an immigrant from mm-hmm. Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Tell us about those early days.
Well, I mean, when you end up going to school with like Jay-Z and Busta Rhymes, that's a pretty good melting pot to grow up in. Again, we look at New York and it's such a cultural melting pot of immigrants and from people who've, you know, obviously come to America to seek better lives for not only themselves but their children. I think when we look at the beginnings of hip hop and particularly with the crop of artists who really sort of came to define the late 80s into the 90s, we're seeing those same early stories of hustle. We're seeing those same early stories of, you know, these kids who are wide-eyed. They're, let's be honest, they're smart asses. That's a very big trait that comes through all of them, all of the sort of legendary stories. But with that smart attitude comes a really hard work ethic. You know, they're seeing their parents struggle. They're often coming from larger families where, you know, there might be the younger children or, you know, these are children who have epic amounts of responsibility put on them. So they're forced to grow up really quickly. And I feel like for the notorious B.I.G., it was very much that kind of situation, being raised by a strong woman who has been such a constant, even after he died, like such a excellent, I guess, executor of his assets and his estate. So being raised by her, but then falling into this lifestyle of, you know, dropping out of school, not really using his smarts and his natural intelligence in the way that his mother wanted, but being able to fall into life on the streets but make it work for him. You know, I feel like one of the most interesting things about what I've read over the years about how Biggie grew up and entered his formative years and I guess entered young adulthood is the fact that everybody seems to say he could have done something really well, like in terms of, you know, becoming an academic or, you know, graduating and, you know, whatever. But, you know, had his first child really young, found some kind of ease in life in dealing drugs and just knowing that lifestyle. But with that always came creativity. And so when his musicality started to become a thing that he knew he could do, there was a really interesting tussle in, do I go with something that is clearly, you know, very intrinsically a talent that I have, or do I stick with what I know that can make me money?
Dealing on now, the street corners. Yeah, yeah.
Like, because now I have a daughter, I've got, you know, someone who's depending on me. Mm. I need to figure that out. And I always found that was a really interesting back and forth that I wonder, I know a lot of artists, a lot of people still have those sorts of struggles now, but back then it's, you know, they didn't have rappers to look at who were glorifying that.
Mm.
Whereas artists have that now. They would look at a career like his and be like, okay, well, he was on the streets, but he's now one of the greatest rappers that ever lived. I'm going to do that too because I come from that. Like, I always wonder what those rappers in the 90s had to reflect on because they didn't have that precedent then, you know? Watch this, Lord.
I always thought it was interesting how his mother used to take the young Biggie, a.k.a. Christopher Wallace, back to Jamaica every year. And, you know, observers have said how, you know, that the Jamaican language and, you know, those kind of rhythms have kind of seeped into his music. Mm. Can you hear and appreciate that as well?
Yeah, definitely in his cadence. I mean, that's why I always thought that he and Busta Rhymes had so much in common in terms of their lyrical ability because they both come from, like, this strong, like, Afro-Caribbean background, but also that culture had, like, they were always very connected to that culture. So I feel like it's almost impossible not to hear such a great hold on rhythm come through that music. And the really laid-back confidence, especially with Biggie's and some of his lyrical ability, lends itself so well on record.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, it's hard to make things sound effortless when you know that they're putting effort in. And that's one of his biggest draw cards is that it sounds like he's just rolled a blunt, gone into the studio, and has just done his thing. And then that's what they've come out of the studio with. Remember back in the days when niggas had waves, gazelle shades and corn braids, pitching pennies, honeys had the high top jellies, shooting skelly. Motherfuckers was all friendly, lounging at the barbecues, drinking brews with the neighborhood crews, hanging on the avenues. Turn your pages to 1993. Niggas is getting smoked, G. Believe me. And then you see the videos of him, you know, rapping on the streets in battles and stuff, and he's just like slaying them, and there's a real attack as well, you know, that he was quite capable of, you know. No one wanted to take him on or cross him or follow him. No, I get that too. Like, it really speaks to how connected he was with the underground, I feel, as well. And even now, like, I mean, he's looked at as a legend, not just in music, but I feel like for the Brooklyn community as well.
Mm.
The first time I remember staying in Bed-Stuy many years ago, like one of the things I can remember most clearly is seeing all the murals of him just on the streets. And some looked really gritty, some looked really sort of idealized, with him with the crown, him with, you know, everything. And you see it for the first time as a fan and you kind of get emotional because you're like, okay, you're walking these streets of Bed-Stuy, you're walking these streets of Clinton Hill where he was born, and you know that this community, you know, it raised him. in a lot of ways. And it also, these streets also challenged him, but they also inspired him. And, you know, that it really, it feels almost tangible when you go to those places and you're like, okay, like it's almost like you could go up to those murals, feel it and be like, he could have battled in front of this wall.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like he could have sat on that stoop over there and saw little Kim walking past for the first time and was like, I want to hear you rap.
Yeah.
You know, it's such an awesome feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's obviously, you know, what he was representing or just channeling on those streets when, I think he was invited. Who was it? It wasn't P. Diddy didn't come along until it was Matty C, I'd heard, at The Source, you know, had a demo that was recorded in someone's basement.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was on the streets, wasn't he? Yeah. He was like just doing those battles.
Yeah. I think he had early co-signs like Big Daddy Kane and some other like early hip hop legends as well. But yeah, that's all he was doing. He was just battling on the streets and then. Yeah, demo made its way to The Source and then it made its way to Uptown.
Yes.
Where Diddy was.
Where Diddy was for a time.
And Diddy got fired and then he launched Bad Boy and then I was like, all on. All on from there. Look up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. Nope, it's Mary J, ain't a damn thing changed. Kicking ill
flavor with the Teflon Dawn. Wrecking shot, getting dropped, she got it going on. One thing that set Biggie apart was his ease with flipping his style to embrace other genres and slower jams, as well as how he viewed women on equal standing.
Just how natural he was on the microphone, you know, how soulful he was on the microphone. He had such a distinct flow and a distinct energy that really translated well from not only gangster rap and more hardcore stuff, but R&B as well, you know. Mm. Even as he became more famous, he didn't shy away from working with R&B artists. He didn't shy away from working with soul artists. You know, some of his earliest successes were on Mary J. Blige remixes.
That's true.
And those remain some of my most favourite songs. Like The Real Love remix is, you know, top five for me. What's the 411? Again, like incredible moments for the genre and for New York as well. So I really enjoyed the fact that he was unafraid to embrace women in that way. I mean, like, that's the other thing, too. Like, he got ladies. Like, some of those.
Certainly was not short on the female fans.
No, he was not. But, you know, he was unafraid of embracing that musical side of himself as well. You know, he shouts out Salt and Pepper heaps. He shouts out, like, all of these pioneering artists, male and female actually, who really set it up for him to sort of blaze a trail on his own. And I feel like that was something I really connected with early too, because, you know, as a female fan of hip hop, especially when I was younger, you know, you can often feel quite isolated.
Excluded.
And excluded and within a genre that, you know, historically has denigrated females, has objectified females, has sexualized females. To see someone like the Notorious B.I.G. who, like, he came out with some jams that were just about, like, loving women down. Even in some of the music videos, like, he's one of the first rappers to notably feature transgender, like, video vixens in some of his music videos, which has only really become more prolific in recent years. But, like, no other rappers were doing that back then, and he was doing it in a way that wasn't tokenistic. It was just like, he really just loved the female form, which is really cool. To all the ladies in the place with style and grace, allow me to lace these lyrical douches in your bushes. Who rock grooves and make moves with all the mommies. The back of the club, sipping my wet is where you find me. One song that made a show of Biggie's legit ladies man credentials was Big Poppa. And the video features trans woman Shamika, who appears in more than one of Biggie's videos. As Sauce said, it showed Biggie wasn't afraid of making bold moves, especially in a time when there was a lot more homophobia and transphobia in hip-hop. Big Poppa is one of the big hits off the debut album Ready to Die, an album that reinstated New York's influence on the genre and introduced a new titan to the scene. Here's Sosa breaking down the seismic impact of the Notorious B.I.G.'s first record. I got into Ready to Die quite quickly, and I realised that that's an album that is, I mean, it's a classic for a reason. You know, Biggie is known for these, like, huge club tracks, which I don't think would have been necessary. I mean, they were very popular at the time, But you look at where they sit, I guess, in the more modern annals of hip hop. Like, those are the standards. Like, you've got Juicy, One More Chance, Give Me the Loot, Big Poppa, all coming through before we get to a track like Who Shot Ya, which I guess a lot of people would consider as the one that really started to kick off rivalries and things like that. But Ready to Die is such a it's such an impactful record, and I love what it meant for East Coast hip hop at that point. Because if we think about it, you know, the early 90s, like 93, 94, we were starting to see the West Coast really assert their dominance in terms of what they were doing with hip hop, but also in terms of how they were changing the identity of the genre. You know, you can hear it in not only in what Tupac was doing, but in what we were hearing from NWA and what we were hearing from Ice-T, Snoop Dogg. Like, there was a real change in language and feel that had really swung that pendulum away from the East Coast. And, you know, New York is where hip hop was born. So I feel like at that point, East Coast hip hop really needed a new champion. And when Biggie came through, and particularly when the Ready to Die record dropped, I feel like it happened at the most perfect of times, because that's what East Coast hip hop needed.
Yeah.
And it really, it shifted the dial, and it brought people back to, I guess, the beginnings of the genre. And I feel like that's why it's such an important record. Who shot you?
Title itself, what is that referencing? I mean, did that seem a little bit kind of hardcore? I'm sure it would have raised some alarm bells with my parents if I was
Ready
into
to
it.
Die.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you
and
think
a guy was associated with gangs and selling drugs and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, if you look at both Ready to Die and Life After Death, they're quite ominous titles when you consider his short life. But then you look at the artwork, and it's like a gorgeous baby on the front, just in his, you know, gorgeous afro, and he's just sitting there. And there's a real sort of purity to that, I feel, which we often see in Biggie's work. There's the way he plays with duality, is it can come across as quite simple, but I feel like when you listen to an album like that front to back, it's really smart, and it shows how much of a fan he is of the, you know, hip hop as a universal sort of entity and everything that comes under that umbrella, which is why we can hear the Mtume sample on Juicy, which is why we can hear that real kind of laid back flow on a track like Big Poppa, and then really leaning into almost the romance of One More Chance as well. It's a really huge takeaway to listen to that record again with.
I think the title for me is like a declaration almost of his convictions.
Yeah,
you know, ready to lay it all down.
Absolutely.
And in the diversity of the ways that he has presented, you know, his flow and
it's a debut as well. Like he's, you know, when we talk about writing hard for your city and writing hard for your people and for your community, like, that was a real big stamp to be like, we're bringing East Coast back. And we're bringing it back in a big way.
What kind of role do you reckon, you know, Sean Puffy Combs had in, you know, did he bring out, you know, sort of extra qualities?
I feel like Diddy was the sort of influence that he needed at that time in his life, because he needed somebody to kind of be in his corner who wasn't just like your homies on the street. Like, he was someone who had incredible business acumen. Like, he was an A&R for Uptown for ages before he launched Bad Boy. And I feel like he needed someone who had that vision to be like, you need to stop. If you really want to make this a thing, we can make this a thing, but you need to learn the business of it. And I feel like he was a really good influence in that way. Mm. Obviously, the relationship wasn't perfect.
Mm.
But when you think about it, like, Bad Boy, at that point, like, Bad Boy and Biggie were coming through at the same time. So these are young dudes who are learning as they
together,
go.
Yeah.
You know, they've got the ambition there. They've, you know, they've got the confidence in their head that they're already the hottest thing going, even though nobody, you know, the notoriety hadn't been there yet. So they're figuring it out as they go along together. And I feel like that's what sort of bonded them really strongly in the beginning.
Right.
And for Biggie, it gave him that just extra boost to know that he could actually have a legitimized career as a hip-hop superstar.
Wild success with Ready to Die.
Yes.
And then, yeah, what's the transition from first to second album like for Biggie?
Well, it's interesting, you know, but again, it's wild to think that, like, Ready to Die comes out in 94. Life After Death is 97. Mm. So there's a short period of time where just everything takes off and we see Biggie become, like, this massive superstar, but also we're starting to see how he's really curating a community underneath him, and he's involved in the success of so many other pivotal artists for that golden era of hip hop too. You know, we're seeing under him the rise of Faith Evans, who he was also married to, incredible R&B singer. Some call her like the, you know, she was a queen of R&B and soul. But at the same time, you know, without Biggie, we wouldn't have seen the emergence of Lil' Kim, who is arguably one of the most important female rappers that there will ever be.
Mm-hmm.
With her in particular, I mean, there's, you know, it's almost legendary now, like the love triangle between Faith, Biggie and Lil' Kim. But artistically, the fact that we had this pivotal male figure being so encouraging to this girl to embrace her sexuality, to embrace this really kind of hardcore rap style that established her as equals to her male counterparts, not anything less than, without losing any sense of sexuality or sensuality, I can't remember a duo that was that powerful together, because it wasn't like he came on the scene and was like, well, she's only successful because of me.
Mm.
It was more like, no. I'm putting her in these places, but everything you're hearing, that's her.
Yeah.
That's her. And he saw that early with her. You know, we saw her come through. We saw Junior Mafia come through, which is obviously like the...
his crew and friends.
The crew.
Yeah.
But all younger artists as well. So Lil C's, Lil Kim, obviously. But, you know, we had some bangers come out of that as well, like Get Money, Plays Anthem. Again, just hip-hop classics. So I feel like that in-between period between Ready to Die and Life After Death, we really started to see Biggie as the music businessman, but also Biggie as, like, the music curator. Knocked up 9 months ago, and what she finna have, she don't know.
She want neo soul, cause hip-hop is old. She don't want no rock and roll. One group Biggie helped raise up was The Roots. Here's Black Thought on how Biggie's standing and reputation helped the Philadelphia band get a leg up.
The Roots, I feel like we had very much to prove. Like, we looked different and sounded different and just had a different feel than most of our contemporaries. A lot of that was due to the fact that we, you know, were creating hip hop with live instrumentation. So, you know, I had to sort of be that much better as an MC. And you know, we had to be that much, you know, just tighter as a unit, as a collective. Everyone had to sort of be at the top of their game in order to, you know, to receive the proper approval, like the never-ending search for validation. You know, getting the cosign from people like Big and Big Pun and, you know, rappers who sort of represented their entire boroughs, and you know, we're that influential in New York. It was huge in sort of solidifying our place, you know, our seat at the table.
Biggie's second album, Life After Death, was a triumphant record filled with collaborations and big hits, and its impact was immediate.
We start to see, and again, I feel like it comes with Biggie becoming more successful in the mainstream. The R&B kind of leaning moments are there, but with this record that we fully start to see a fusion between like gangster rap and pop records come through, which is why I think a record like Hypnotize or Mo Money, Mo Problems has had the endurance that it's had, because white crowds can bump it as easy as black crowds could, you know what I mean? So it's like, I feel like it was one of the first records that we really started to see be properly embraced by the mainstream, because by that point, 97, hip-hop's in its golden era. You had Fugees, you had Tupac, you had all of these, you know, artists who were really sort of churning out the classics.
Mm.
And then, yeah, Biggie comes out and it's just like people already know him. They're invested in him at that point. So it's another really pivotal and impactful record for the culture because of that reason, I feel. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
It's the 10 crack commandments.
Sadly, Life After Death was a posthumous record, arriving just weeks after Biggie was killed in a drive-by shooting in Los Angeles. His death followed a long and heightened dispute with his former friend Tupac Shakur, who himself had been killed months earlier. Source says this was a turning point for the deadly East Coast-West Coast hip-hop feud.
The whole thing was a real sad, it was a sad waste of talent. Again, it's kind of become mythological. There are so many documentaries about, you know, who killed who, was it an inside job, were the FBI involved? Like, it's kind of gone a bit ridiculous over the years. But at the end of the day, it's like these are two young men who were doing some really great things for their communities, who got caught up in, you know, a lifestyle that was maybe too much or too unpredictable, and they didn't have the right people around them, and this is what happens, you know. Just these musicians who are really trying to do good things, and they resonate so well with young people in their community as a way out of street life, as a way out of the poverty that has kind of been assigned to them. And it's really sad that it's still happening today. But I feel like we look at the East Coast, West Coast rivalry in the 90s, when both of those artists died, we saw a shift on both camps of being like, okay, it's gone too far. Now
we've lost two greats.
Now for what? For what?
When we are looking over Biggie's legacy, which, you know, frankly, is resting on two albums that were released in his lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, that says volumes about the man's impact, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you think about how many times he's been sampled across the years on really big songs as well, like Ashanti's Unfoolish, the remastered version of One More Chance and Stay With Me. We've heard SWV, Monica, Ice Cube, even Joey Badass, more these days. Jay-Z's even taken from him. Like, the man's pen game was so incredibly strong that it's often mind-blowing to me that there's only two records of recorded material when he was actually alive. I mean, obviously, I think there was the Born Again record that came out in, like, 99-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, recorded material that actually happened in his lifetime, for someone who didn't even hit 30, it's wild. It's absolutely wild. Not many people will be able to, I mean, they haven't been able to touch it.
Yeah.
Really.
His time on this earth was tragically cut short, but Biggie's legacy has endured for decades. His stories and songs, many of which were written about the streets that raised and schooled him, continue to find new fans and inspire new generations as the years go by. The J-Files is a Double J podcast. Make sure you like, follow and share. Our producer is Gab Burke. Theme music is by Art vs. Science. You can check out Double J anytime on the Triple J app or at doublej.net.au. I'm Kaz Tran. Thanks for listening.